I have found out that the Lord's servants are some of the most fun people around, and we're going to prove that right now. The other thing I was reminded was that Mrs. Mary Ray is a fun person to be around. I mean, she just really is. And Ms. Ray, have you ever had anything humorous to happen to y'all in these years of ministry? Anything funny ever happen? Quite a few things. I mean, beyond living with this man right here. Quite a few things. Would you mind coming and just sharing something with us here in just a minute about something funny that happened? This crowd, they're just so dull and all. We just need to liven them up a little bit. And then, Brinson, I'm sure there must have been something funny about living in 130-degree weather. Would you mind doing this? Anything funny happened there in the desert? Okay, I thought so. You're next, my brother. All right, after Ms. Ray, you're next here. And then without any further ado, Brother Ray is going to come and preach. And he's been threatening us with a ghost story, no joke, ever since last night or Sunday night or whatever it was. It must have been last night. I wasn't here Sunday night. But that ought to be interesting as well. But let's see. Ms. Ray, would you mind, please, ma'am?
We wives love this because, see, the men are always in the pulpit, and they're always telling things about us, and this is our chance. Of course, in ministry, as European director and also as president for BIMI, we've traveled in many, many countries of the world, and of course, there are so many different customs. When we would get to Russia, often the pastors would say to him, "Now, when you sit on the platform, don't cross your legs. That's offensive. You're offensive to the people. don't put your hands in your pockets because that's offensive to the people." So many things you have to remember. But we were in one part of the Ukraine in a church, and just wonderful, wonderful people. But you know the scripture that says to greet each other with a holy kiss? Well, in that area and in that church, they literally did that. The women did each other on the cheeks, but the men greeted each other with a holy kiss, and it was right in the mouth. Well, I had more fun than I'd ever had in my life watching my husband trying to avoid the holy kisses. He would see a man coming, and he would grab him by the shoulder, and he'd take his hand, "God bless you, brother," you know, and he was literally holding them off. Well, one night, one got loose, and he had really big lips.
Hey, Brinson, forget it, buddy. You'll never be able to top that, bud. I mean, no, come on. I assure all you crooked creakers, that ain't never going to happen around here, all right? Oh, you're right, preacher. I won't be able to top that one. But I will think of something. There was probably some things that just not coming to mind in the desert. But I'll tell you one thing that really cracked my wife up. We were actually in language school in France at the time. And we were at the supermarket. We had just been there just a few months learning French. And I was, of course, wanting to practice my French and there with the lady, and we were actually getting some film developed, and it was some pictures of the ultrasound we had done of Mary Ann. And so I decided, all right, I was feeling brave that day. I'd go up and, you know, engage in conversation and try to get to use what we'd been learning. Well, when I got up to the counter, I was doing well, greeting, you know, bonjour, ça va bien, and just going well. And then I decided, I said, oh, here's a perfect opportunity. Here's some pictures of our baby. And so I decided I'd ask her, would you like to see some pictures of our baby? But I didn't ask that. I actually said in French, I won't say it, but I asked her, would you like to see a picture of your baby? Her eyes got that big around, and my wife in French was saying, no, your baby, you know, my baby. So it was, her face was red, my face was red, my wife's face was red. And but anyway, she was very gracious, and those sort of things happen all the time out in the mission field and learning the languages. But yeah, there was a few other things. If I think of something out there in Niger, I'll bring it up. Thank you, preacher.
All right, man, Joanne kept me right on the edge of my seat talking about being out in the desert at 140 degrees in the daytime. And Eden, did you ever eat any of that camel? You ate. I guess it'd be okay after you got over the hump, I guess. But wow. What a life. There was a man, though some did count him mad, the more he gave away, the more he had. How can you do that? How can you give more away and have more? Now, that's the law of giving. And God will never let you, nobody in this building will ever die and say, I gave God. I gave you God more than you gave me. It'll never happen. Because he's a great God and a generous God. And be praying and asking God what he have you do on Sunday. There was a man, though some did count him mad. The more he gave away, the more he had. Never, never outgive God. And I appreciate so much this great church and your pastor. He took us to the Mexican restaurant. I was so glad that years ago I had a semester of Spanish. I really was. I don't remember it all, but I do remember a little bit of it. Si and no. I remember that much, you know. But it's been great being here and wonderful to be here with all of you. Let me just mention you have a couple of DVDs, Footprints in Blood. Mary and I have followed the steps of the martyrs, John Huss, all of them, who gave their life for the faith. Have a couple of those, only a couple of each one, and America and the Steps of the Pilgrims. The history is being rewritten. And they're trying to say the pilgrims came and they kind of made way for all religions. You know, it's amazing what they're doing. But we got it straight. America and the Steps of the Pilgrims, we've been back to where William Bradford lived, where he was born, in fact, followed their steps all the way through England to Plymouth, England, here. And so we got to have that. And then the last one, the Trail of Tears. And how many of you have heard of the Trail of Tears? How many of you have maybe some Cherokee in your family or something like that? Well, a lot of you do, okay? And the amazing thing is that one of the great tragedies of America, and the amazing thing, though, what was really largely unknown is that there were great, great missionaries who worked with the Cherokees and the five civilized tribes who were herded out to the desert in Oklahoma. And it's a great, great story. These missionaries actually went with the Cherokees on the Trail of Tears, went out to Oklahoma and died out there with them. It's just a great, great story. And I wanted to do that for a long time until we just got that done. And so they're back there. Then, of course, that $14.95 a piece goes back in the book fund. The Baptists like free things, so please be sure and get a copy of the Nations magazine. And by the way, if you want to read about the Sahara Project that started way back there in the 70s, and also how Brother Jensen is following the steps of these people, working out in the Niger. So we've got a couple of articles in there like that, so be sure and get that. Now take your Bible, if you will, now, and turn in your Bible to John chapter 2, the second chapter of John. John and the second chapter. I can imagine learning another language, a different language. Mary and I were in Australia, and we were in England, but they speak English shorter in those countries. And so we haven't had to go through learning languages. We had a little list of signs from England and other places that just came out funny. They weren't meant to be funny. In a laundromat, it said, had a little sign, automatic washing machines. Please remove all your clothes when the light goes out. Well, it meant on the washing machine. In a London department store, bargain basement upstairs. In an office, will the person who took the step ladder yesterday please bring it back or further steps will be taken. And then here's one, noticing a dry cleaner's window, anyone leaving their garments here for more than 30 days will be disposed of. And in a health food store shop window, had a little sign said, closed due to illness. And then here's another one, seen during a conference, for anyone who has children and doesn't know it, there's a daycare on the first floor. Message on the leaflet. If you cannot read, this leaflet will tell you how to get lessons. On a repair shop door, we can repair anything. Please knock hard on the door. The bell doesn't work. You know. Mary and I were going through Kentucky, coming up to Louisville. There was a big billboard, and it said, tattoos while you wait. Now, can you imagine? I pick my tattoo up in an hour. You know, you gotta wait. And in another office, after the tea break, staff should empty the teapot and stand upside down on the drain board. And I gotta stop and preach. I know. I'll close with this. Outside of a secondhand shop, we exchange anything: bicycles, washing machines. Why not bring your wife along and get a wonderful bargain? You know. I got to preach. Okay. John chapter 2. John chapter 2. Hope you found your place there. And the second chapter of John, beginning with verse 1. And the third day there was a marriage in Cana of Galilee, and the mother of Jesus was there. And both Jesus was called and his disciples to the marriage. And when they wanted wine, the mother of Jesus saith unto him, they have no wine. Jesus saith unto her, woman, what have I to do with thee? My hour is not yet come. His mother saith unto the servants, whatsoever he saith unto you, do it. And there was set there 6 water pots of stone, after the manner of the purifying of the Jews, containing 2 or 3 firkins apiece. Jesus saith unto them, fill the water pots with water. They filled them up to the brim. And he saith unto them, draw out now and bear unto the governor of the feast. And they bear it. When the ruler of the feast had tasted the water that was made wine, and knew not whence it was, but the servants which drew the water knew, the governor of the feast called the bridegroom, and saith unto him, every man at the beginning doth set forth good wine, and when men are well drunk, then that which is worse, and thou hast kept the good wine until now. Some people try to use that for license to social drink, and boy, Jesus made wine. About the only verses they've got is a little wine for your stomach, and Jesus made wine. The other was medication for purposes, and the wine Jesus made was not the stuff that they have out there today. Of course, they had wine. Excuse me. But what he made was something far different from what they were serving. First of all, didn't have time to ferment. He said, well, he was God. He could make it ferment immediately. Didn't have time to ferment. But on the other hand, the other second reason I know it was not the fermented wine was because would Jesus make anything that would make a man beat his wife and lie and swear and steal? I don't think so. But the wonderful story is that he produced this wine, or even in the Bible times they called it wine, the grape wine and the grape, and grape juice wine. But he was different from the other, and the ruler said so. But what I want to draw your attention to is verse 5. His mother saith unto the servants, whatsoever he saith unto you, do it. Now that ought to be the theme of our lives. Every day we need to have a personal interview with God. And whatever he says unto us, we need to do it. We have a missionary friend in England by the name of Glenn Palmer. Glenn was born in England. His mother was an English woman, married an American serviceman, came back to the States when Glenn was about 6 years old. He was saved when he became an adult, went to Tennessee Temple University, and then met a young girl from Lookout Mountain, Tennessee, and they were married. And God called Glenn to go back to England to reach his own people and go back to the locale where he grew up, did some of his growing up in. And Glenn has a lot of relatives back in that part of England. And some time ago, Mary and I drove over to see Glenn, and he took us to see one of those relatives, his Aunt May. She lived in a huge house. This is one of the most unusual visits that Mary and I have ever made. She lived in this house, was really a mansion. Some people call it a castle. And we turned off the main road in the car. I felt like the car was a time machine, taking me back in time. That house has stood on those grounds for 700 years, and since about 1300. And Aunt May, Glenn's Aunt May, lived in that house all by herself. Aunt May was everything you would expect an English lady to be, trim, polished, British accent. And the house was huge, 20-plus rooms. And in those rooms, you had knight's armor, you had chandeliers, paintings dating back for centuries of time. And we sat by the fire a while, and then Aunt May said, would you like to see the house? Well, Mary and I were dying to see the house. And I said, well, yes. And so she showed us around that huge house, huge rooms upstairs and downstairs, and she lived there all by herself. And we came through a little dark passageway, and Aunt May paused, and she said, but I've never seen the ghost. And I didn't ask her any questions because Glenn had already given me the details of the ghost story that is connected with this house. A true story, a tragic story that dates back for several 100 years. Several hundred years back when the Lovell family, and it's called Lovell Hall, and when the Lovell family owned that house, Lovell's son was engaged to marry a local village girl, and they had a big wedding party on Christmas Eve. And they danced and all that they do at those things. And after a while, the bride said, let's play a game. And everybody wants to please a bride on a wedding day. So they said, okay, what would you like to play? She said, I'd like to play hide and seek. And I thought we invented that game in Georgia, but I guess it's been around a while. And so they closed their eyes, and the bride ran off in the house someplace to hide. And after a few minutes, they started searching for her, and they couldn't find her. They searched all downstairs, and they looked behind furniture and doors, and they couldn't find her. Then they went upstairs, and they searched all the large rooms on the next floor. They couldn't find her. And so finally, they went out into the garden where the hedgerows, and they searched all through the gardens trying to find Lovell's bride, but they couldn't find her. And eventually, they searched all night, and all the next day, and all the next week, and the next month, until finally they gave it up. And Lovell died, an old man, and he never found his bride and never knew what happened to her. And some people who lived in the house many years later went up into an attic, into the uppermost part of the attic. And you have to see the place to understand how this could all happen. Way up in the attic of that house, over in a dark corner, there was a huge chest. And they opened the chest and they found the bones of a young bride. Of a young girl who had hidden there, and she climbed in there. When the lid came down, a secret latched, and it was all over for her. And the British believe her ghost comes out every night and roams through the house. It's well known for hundreds of years that story has been told, and it happened in the house of one of our missionaries in England, Lynn Pollen. A ballad grew up around that tragic true story. The mistletoe hung in the castle hall. The holly branch shone on the old oak wall. And the baron's retainers were blithe that day, keeping their Christmas holiday. The baron beheld with father's pride his beautiful child, young Lovell's bride, while she with a bright eye seemed to be the star of the goodly company. "I'm weary of dancing now," she cried. "Here, tarry a moment, I'll hide, I'll hide." And away she ran, her friends began, each tower to search, each nook to scan. And young Lovell cried, "Oh, where do you hide? I'm lonesome without you, my own dear bride." They sought her that night. They sought her next day. They sought her in vain till a week passed away. In the highest, the lowest, the loneliest spot, young Lovell sought fiercely, but found her not. The years flew by, and the grief at last was told as a sorrowful tale long past. And when Lovell appeared, the children cried. See, the old man weeps for his fairy bride. At length an oak chest that long lain hid, was found in the castle. They raised the lid, and a skeleton form lay moldering there in the bridal wreath of the lady fair. Oh, sad was her fate in sportive jest. She hid from her love in the old oak chest. It closed for the spring, and her bridal bloom lay withering there in a living tomb. And that's the true story. And the British, you know, some of the British are serious about their ghosts. Not all of them, but some of them very, very serious. And I even had some believers who, and we had to try to direct them in the right way. But they believe that her ghost roams through that house every night and has for all those centuries of time. Now, again, I do not believe in ghosts, okay? Now, you got that last night, right? I don't believe in ghosts. So nobody, you visitors especially, don't go away and say, "Brother Tom had a preacher that believes in ghosts. I don't believe in ghosts." Now, you got that right. Maybe you better say it with me. "Brother Ray doesn't believe in ghosts." "Brother Ray." Oh, you got to do it loud on that. "Brother Ray." Okay, we got that settled, okay? I don't believe in ghosts. But there's not enough money in the whole world to pay me to stay one night by myself at Lovell Hall. I don't believe in ghosts, but I'm still scared of them. Well, whether or not you believe in ghosts, Lovell Hall represents the ghost of tragedy. A young bride on her day of days, I mean, all of her dreams were wrapped up in that particular day. But because of a childish game, everything was forfeited, and when that latch clicked, it was all over. I thought about that, and I thought there's some games that people play today that are tragic. They play the game of degradation, living in sin, dabbling with pornography and drugs and evil thoughts and a life of evil acts. The game of degradation, the game of procrastination, waiting until another day, a future time, to make vitally important decisions. Tomorrow is a better day to praise thy holy name. Tomorrow, said the Son of Man, but tomorrow never came. And we think of the words of the writer of Proverbs, "Boast not thyself of tomorrow, for thou knowest not what a day may bring forth." The game of procrastination. They play the game of stagnation. Not hot, not cold, just lukewarm. But God says, "I know thy work, that thou art neither cold nor hot. I would thou were cold or hot. Show them because thou art lukewarm and neither cold nor hot, I will spew thee out of my mouth. And then they have a game of preoccupation. They're too busy. People are so past and I. We're talking about how busy people are today. Hard to even get time to witness to them sometime because they've got so much on the agenda. The game of preoccupation. A lot of things can keep your mind off of God. Television can do it. People can do that. Wearing too many hats. Belonging to too many organizations. Dangerous games that people play. And there are some ghosts that will return to haunt us in eternity. The ghosts of too young. And the ghosts of too happy. And the ghosts of too busy. And the ghosts of too old. And finally, the ghost of too late. Lovell's bride heard the click of a secret latch. And it was too late. And all that could have been was forfeited in that little bit of time. We learn from things like that. Don't play games with something as serious as life. We learn, guard against making thoughtless and tragic mistakes with that which is sacred. We learn there are some points of no return in our lives. If in our lives we are to avoid the ghost of tragic mistakes, we must meet God every day. And we must counsel with Him and meet Him and have an interview with God every day. And whatever He says unto us, we need to do it. Let me give you some simple things to help you to avoid the ghost of tragic mistakes. Number one, know God as a living person. Daniel 2:28, there is a God in heaven, he said. What kind of a God? And you say, Brother Ray, you're preaching to the wrong people. We all believe there's a God in heaven, but sometimes we act like we don't. Sometimes we almost despair when we should believe in Him and trust in Him. And there is really is a God in heaven. What kind of a God is He? He's a sovereign God. Matthew 10:30, but the very hairs of your head are all numbered. He knows everything there is about us. Sometimes when you say you believe in the sovereignty of God, people think, you know, you believe this doctrine of extreme election. God has a group all picked out, and they going to let them. He's going to let them go to heaven. And by the vast majority, He has decreed they go to hell. His sovereignty demands that we choose. And He put the choice in our hands. If you will, but the sovereignty of God is a wonderful thing. Nothing can happen to you that God does not allow. Turn to Psalm 139. Psalm 139. It's comforting to know that God knows everything about us. Psalm 139. And let's read a few verses there. And if you see the verses, it'll help you a lot. Psalm 139. The sovereignty of God and His correct teaching is a wonderful, wonderful truth. Psalm 139, verse 1. O Lord, Thou hast searched me and known me. You ever had the IRS come in and do an audit? I've not had that pleasure yet, but who knows? But they say when they come in, they know everything about you. They know, they get into your bank deposit box, and they check all your records, and they just know it all. They search you thoroughly. But nobody searched you like God. Thou hast searched me and known me. And then verse 2, Thou knowest my down sitting. When you stood up that just a while ago, you sat down on a hymn. God in heaven saw you with your name sitting down. How can He be so detailed? If He can count, if He knows every hair on your head, He certainly knows every person. He saw you when He sat down, and Thou knowest my down sitting. And my uprising, when you stood up to sing, God saw you. Thou understandest my thoughts afar off. When you go out of here and you go out to the car tonight and you're thinking about something, God is registering your thoughts. And look at verse 3. Thou compassest my path and my lying down. When you get home tonight and you put your head on your pillow, God is taking note of you doing that. My lying down, acquainted with all my ways. Not a word in my tongue, but, O Lord, Thou knowest it altogether. Every whisper, every thought, every word, the sovereign God of ours takes note, and He knows. Look at verse 9. I take the wings of the morning and dwell in the uttermost part of the sea. Even there shall Thy hand lead me, and Thy right hand shall hold me. If I say, surely the darkness shall cover me, even the night shall be light about me. I love what Joanne said, that God was taking care of them out in the desert. He knows where you are. You cannot get so far out into the world that God will not know your email address and your phone number and your location and know exactly where you are. And this is free. Look at verse 17. Sometimes people say, no, I don't have any friends. Nobody likes me. Nobody ever thinks about me. Wrong. Look at verse 17. How precious also are Thy thoughts unto me, O God. How great is the sum of them. God is thinking about you. Verse 18, if I should count them, that is the times that God thinks about me or you, they are more in number than the sand. God is thinking about you all the time. There is a God in heaven. Meet Him every morning. He's a sovereign God. He's a seeing God. In Romans 2:16, in the day when God shall judge the secrets of men. You've been watched. I just said it. When you walk down the path, when you stand up, when you sit down, when you lie down at night, when you think, when you speak, God is watching you. And all through the Bible, we've got tons of verses about His eyes being on you, God looking at you, God following you, God watching you. And sometimes people say, you know, I know what He's doing. He's just waiting until I trip. He's just waiting until I fall, and then He's going to zap me. But that's not what it means. I think what all these verses mean about God looking at you and God watching you, He can't get you off His mind. He loves you so much, He thinks about you all the time. What a God He is. He's a seeing God. He's a saving God. Hebrews 7:25, wherefore He's able also to save them to the uttermost or to the guttermost. There's nobody too far gone. There's nobody alive that God could not save if they would only turn to Him. Nobody too far gone that they turn to God that He wouldn't save. Paul referred to himself as the chief of sinners. So if you ever have somebody say, He'll never save me after all the things I've done, you tell them the chief of sinners has already been saved. There won't be any problem with the Indians. I mean, the chief's already been saved. He can save you. He can save anybody. He's a saving God. Mary and I our children lived about 25 miles from a little town of Olney, England. Olney, England, there's a church that's still there, and that church has been there since 1300. John Newton, who wrote Amazing Grace, used to pastor that church, probably wrote the song while he was there. When John Newton was about six years old, his mother died. She was a Salvation Army woman. She taught him verses. Remember, he memorized verses. She died when he was six. His father was a sea captain. His father would go off to sea months at a time, put John in a boarding school. When John grew up, he followed in his father's footsteps, and he joined the Royal Navy, got into the Navy, finally got out of the Navy, and got into the slave trade, got his own slave ship. Now, if you've ever been to Charleston, South Carolina, that's an old slave market down there now. And John Newton, who wrote Amazing Grace, in his own ship, would bring loads of slaves and auction them off on that block that's still there in South Carolina. But the day came when it all changed for John Newton. And he was on a ship coming back to England. And his language was so vile that the captain had to say, "Sir, please don't use that language on my ship." He walked on the deck that night, and verses that his mother had taught him, they memorized years ago, came floating back to his heart. He didn't believe that anymore. He twisted those verses. That night, he was down in his bed down in the ship. The ship got into a mighty storm, and the ship started rolling and tossing, and he heard somebody up on deck say, "She's sinking." John Newton ran up, and he worked with the captain and the crew all night, putting beeswax and lamb's wool into the cracks. And every second of the night, they thought the ship would go under the waves and to the bottom of the sea, and they would all die. And after they had done everything they could do, John Newton turned to the captain, and he said, "If this won't do, may the Lord have mercy on us." "Wait a minute, John. You don't believe in that anymore, remember?" I mean, just hours before, he was walking the deck, and the verses came back to him, and he twisted those verses. But now in a stormy night, in the blackness of a storm, on the deck of a sinking ship, the still, sweet voice of mother's verses were germinating in his heart. The voices uttered long ago, and that night John Newton was saved by grace. And that changed everything. And then he fought the slave trade and became a great Christian and wrote that great hymn. I'm telling you, our God is a saving God. He can save anybody. And He's a sustaining God. You need God when you're saved. Some people have the idea that to accept Christ is a fire escape. I mean, you're going to hell, take Christ, and then you go to heaven, and then they resume their regular pattern of living. And you wonder about conversions like that. But some people feel like he's a fire escape. But you need God not only to be saved, you need Him other times. When I graduated from Temple years ago, Dr. David Allen from Michigan, I believe, spoke at the baccalaureate service, and I believed him. He said, "Young people, there's coming a day when only God will be able to help you." Now I believed him. But I've had a lot of those days now. And some of you have had a lot of those days. Kathy was telling me about her husband. And some of you, you've just lost dear loved ones. And you've had some of those days when nobody but God could help you. When my call came to England and my brother had been murdered, I needed God. When my sister died at 38, I needed God. When another sister died at 24 of cancer, I needed God. When mother died, I needed God. When daddy died, I needed God. Days when only God could help me. And there's coming that time that you need somebody to sustain you. When John Wesley was dying, he said, best of all, God is with us. Now, every day have a personal interview with God and know that God is a living person. And then understand that life is a passing sphere. Life is passing. It's quick. And with few exceptions, 60 years from now, nobody in this building will be alive. We'll be gone from the earth with a few exceptions of younger people. Only one life will soon be passed. Only what's done for Christ will last. Moses said in Psalm 90:10, the days of our years are 70 years. That's 70. He said you might live to be 80. You might have a few more years. James said, go to now you that say today or tomorrow, we would go into such a city and continue there a year and buy and sell and get gain. Whereas you know not what shall be on tomorrow. And then he said, but what is your life? And then he answered that, it is even a vapor that appeareth for a little time and then vanisheth away. The psalmist said in Psalm 103, verse 15 and 16, as for man, his days are as grass, as a flower of the field, so he flourishes. For the wind passes over it and is gone, and the place thereof shall know it no more. When Gandhi, the great leader of India, was dying, 15 years before he died, he said, Hinduism satisfies my soul. Right before he died, he said, all about me is darkness. I am praying for light, praying for light. Oh, my friend, life is so short. Years ago, we live in Leicester. If you have a map of England, put your finger right in the center, you'd be on top of Leicester, the central city of England. Mary and I lived there in that particular city for 5 years. Many, many years ago, a politician was coming through Leicester, and he became very ill and actually died in Leicester. And he made the statement on his deathbed. He said, I wish I had served God half as much as I've served my king. You know, deathbeds are coming. Life is a passing sphere. Your deathbed is coming and mine is. And when we lie down to die, will we, with a ghost of wasted years, return to haunt us, missed opportunities? I've never heard him I say on the deathbed, and I've stood by a few, and Pastor has. I wish I spent more time in the factory, or wish I spent more time in the office. I wish I spent more time shopping at the mall. Some of the ladies might do that. I don't think so. I wish I spent more time watching television. No, I've never heard those kind of things on deathbeds. I've heard things like, wish I not waited so long to be baptized. I wish I not waited so long to join the church. I wish I'd been saved earlier. I wish I'd spent more time with my wife or my children. I've heard things like that. I had a man saved in Illinois in the church I pastored, about 38 years old he was, and just became an outstanding Christian. He died about 42 and 43. And he came up from office and grieving because of this, the death was coming, and he said, I just wasted so much of my life. Just grieved over all the wasted years, the past and fear of our life. Life is quick, and life is passing. And if I could just really get that in your heart tonight, we're not here long. And so we've got to let God have His way in our lives. The past and fear of our lives, like a plane on a runway taking off for the sky, or like a race car speeding down the raceway to reach the finish line, or a salmon fighting the rapids to get back to the place of birth to die, or a tree bent by the autumn winds to shake the last leaf of summer from its branches. Life is a passing sphere. John 2 and verse 5 says, whatsoever he saith unto you, do it, because life is quick. And then, understand this and keep this before you. The world is a perishing race. John 3:16, God so loved the world, He gave His only begotten Son, whosoever believeth in Him should not perish. You know, we spend millions of dollars on paint to keep wood from perishing. We spend millions on conservation to keep land from perishing, and on insurance to keep life from perishing. Billions on defense to keep freedom from perishing. But when God wanted to keep you from perishing, He died for you. He came down and died on the cross. The population has now reached 7 billion plus people, men, women, and children, and they're perishing without God. God blesses men. God doesn't bless buildings. Thank God for buildings. Somebody says, well, London was really blessed when Spurgeon was there. No, Spurgeon was blessed, and London got the overflow. Well, India was really blessed when William Carey went out there. No, God blessed William Carey, and India got the blessing. And F.B. Meyer lived in Leicester, and when he lived there, Leicester was really blessed. No, God blessed F.B. Meyer, and so Leicester got blessed. God blessed his people, and he wants to bless you so that you can win other people to Jesus Christ. Someone has written, the king must lay aside his crown, step down from the throne and lie down before the beggar in the clods of the valley. The minister must pronounce his final benediction, close his Bible, and surrender his flock to the great shepherd of the sheep. The judge must change his judicial robes for garments of the grave. The lawyer must write his last brief and finish his final litigation. The author, his last column. The poet, his final verse. The athlete, play his last game. The musician, his final note. The actor must play his last scene and leave the stage forever. The laborer must leave his plow in the field. The soldier must march for the last time. The mother must leave her helpless babe alone. And the innocent, playful child must drop his toys with his tiny arms and grapple with death. What it all means is the world is a perishing race. We're not here forever. We're not here for long. And your family is perishing. How important it is that you don't wait to witness. You don't wait to be a testimony. They're perishing. Your neighbors are perishing. Your relatives are perishing. Your friends. And it won't be their ghost you meet. It'll be them. It'll be their spirit when you get to heaven. God, and think about it, God is holding you accountable for them. He has placed you there in this circle of people, and He's holding you accountable for a witness to all of these people. One last thing briefly, view heaven as a place of accountability. You know, heaven's a wonderful place. No more death, no more pain, golden streets, gates of pearls, and all of that, and that's ours. But you have to remember that it's also a place of accountability. When we must give account to God. There's a great verse in the Bible, and you listen, I won't make you turn to it. It's in Romans 4, verse 12. Listen to it. So then, every one of us should give account of himself or herself to God. Every one of us. There's a God in heaven to whom we must give account. Everyone. No exceptions. Of himself, Romans 2:16, in the day when God should judge the secrets of men. In 2 Corinthians, we have that scripture about the judgment seat of Christians, or judgment seat of Christ, when Christians will be judged. Not to see whether they're saved or not, but to see what kind of reward they get. Our lives will be judged. It goes like this. We must all appear before the judgment seat of Christ, that everyone may receive the things done in his body, according to that he hath done, whether it be good or bad, in his body, in your life. Your life will be seen. Verse 11, and the next verse says, know it, and therefore the terror of the Lord we persuade men. The judgment seat of Christ is not going to be a picnic. And we must all, when we go to heaven, we must stand before God and before the gaze and search of God. Heaven is a place, of accountability. It says, everyone, no exemptions, of himself, to God. 5 minutes after I die, loved ones will weep over my silent face. Dear ones will clasp me in sad embrace. Shadows and darkness will fill the place. 5 minutes after I die, faces of sorrow I will not see. Voices that murmur will not reach me. But where, oh, where will my spirit be? 5 minutes after I die, quickly the years of my life have flown. Gathering treasures I thought my own. There I must reap the seeds I have sown. 5 minutes after I die, and the tragedy at Lovell Hall was nothing compared to meeting God like this with empty hands and an empty life, an empty service. A little Greek boy came forward in Australia. He was about 7 years old. And he came, I stepped off the platform about like this and met him right there and took him by the hand and said, son, why have you come? He said something in his simplicity that was astounding. He said, I came because God has been talking to my heart. And that's profound. And maybe tonight there's somebody here like that. Maybe God has been talking to you. Maybe about being a better witness. Maybe about forgiveness. maybe about serving Christ full time, maybe about being saved. Maybe in this place, the Redeemer has been talking to you. And if He has, whatsoever He saith unto you, do it.